This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, October 7, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, today is the 10th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. Protesters in Kabul and the U.S. mark the occasion. In Syria, security forces fire on protesters. We'll speak to an opposition leader about next steps in the pro-democracy movement. And critics and supporters of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline speak out as the government nears a decision on the project. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Alice Olstein with headlines for FSRN. This year's Nobel Peace Prize will be shared by three women, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and peace activist Lema Bowie and Yemeni activist and journalist Tawakkul Karman. Karman is a leading figure in the uprising against President Ali Abdullah Saleh and founded the Women Journalists Without Chains. Sirleaf became Africa's first democratically elected female president in 2006 and is running for re-election next week. Bowie directs the Women, Peace, and Security Network and has worked to raise awareness of rape and abuse of women across Africa. The three women will equally share the $1.5 million prize. In Chile, student strikes continue as the country takes up a national referendum on education. All citizens over 14 can weigh in today and Saturday on whether education should be free and guaranteed by the state at every level, and whether giving public funds to for-profit schools should be prohibited. Caroline Lewis reports from Santiago.
Last week, the government promised to raise the education budget by over 7% and create a $4 billion student scholarship fund. But after Wednesday's meeting with Minister of Education Felipe Bulnes, university and high school students in Chile once again abandoned the table of dialogue. Student leaders cited the government's unwillingness to consider the students' demands of free education for all Chileans. On Thursday, students attempted to march in Santiago, but police immediately dispersed demonstrators with tear gas bombs and water cannons. Over 130 were arrested, according to government statistics. Patricio, a first year at the University of Chile, witnessed the scene from the school's main building, which is being occupied by protesting students.
During the day, we suffered strong police repression. A little while ago, we had a kid here whose eye was injured because he was hit by a gas bomb thrown by a police officer. We had to send him to the emergency room.
President Piñera signed a bill last week that would criminalize the occupation of schools as well as the disruption of the free flow of individuals and vehicles on bridges, streets, and roads. Caroline Lewis, FSRN, Santiago.
Attempts by U.S. airlines to avoid having to meet new European carbon emission standards have taken a hit in court. A preliminary ruling says the EU can legally force airlines that fly to Europe to participate in the bloc's carbon cap-and-trade program. Liam Moriarty reports from Normandy.
Starting next year, the aviation industry will be included in Europe's cap-and-trade program. Airlines based in the U.S. and other countries are challenging the new rule, saying Europe has no right to impose regulations on foreign airlines. An advocate general at the European Court of Justice issued an opinion Thursday that the requirement is legal under international law. Bill Hemmings with Transport and Environment, a Brussels-based nonprofit that intervened in the case, says the industry really doesn't have much to complain about.
The cost is extremely modest. The costs will be passed on in their entirety to passengers. All of these objections seem to be a way for international airlines to avoid their responsibilities for the climate.
EU officials estimate that transatlantic ticket prices would rise just 6 to 12 euros, about $8 to $16. The full court won't rule on the matter till next year, though it usually affirms the preliminary opinion. The EU emission rules for aviation are slated to go into effect January 1st. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics announced today that the U.S. created 103,000 jobs in September, and official unemployment still hovers at 9.1%. However, that rate climbs to 16.5% when including individuals who have given up or are unable to look for work, or are working only part-time but want to work full-time. The official unemployed percentage of African Americans, 16.1%, is more than double that of white Americans, at 8%. And nearly 45% of the unemployed have been looking for work for more than 6 months. The Queen's Supreme Court issued a verdict Thursday with far-reaching implications for domestic violence survivors. Noelle Hanrahan has the story.
After a month-long trial, Barbara Sheehan was acquitted of second-degree murder. Sheehan had admitted shooting retired New York City Police Sergeant Raymond Sheehan 11 times in February 2008 at their home in Howard Beach, Queens. She also testified about decades of domestic violence. The jury began the week hopelessly deadlocked. After instruction from the bench that they could deliver a split verdict, they announced an acquittal on the murder charge and a guilty verdict on criminal possession of a weapon. Sheehan will turn herself in and serve time at Rikers Island while she awaits sentencing in November. The weapons charge carries a minimum 3-year term and a potential 15-year sentence. Sheehan told reporters her arrest was something of a mixed blessing.
Being arrested was horrible, and it was degrading and humiliating, but I actually felt safer in jail than I did in my own house with my husband. I was safer there than I was living here.
Sheehan's attorney, Michael Dowd, told FSRN that he's researching whether the weapons charge can stand without a conviction on the primary crime. Noelle Hanrahan, FSRN, Queens.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Washington, D.C., I'm Alice Olstein.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. It was 10 years ago today that U.S. and British forces began bombing Afghanistan and setting into motion a war that is still ongoing. Yesterday, some 300 people marched through Kabul demanding the immediate withdrawal of U.S. and international forces. One man who joined the protest reflected on a decade of war.
Now it is 10 years on from this occupation by the U.S. and its allies in Afghanistan. Our people suffered a lot of instability and poverty increased. There are no other benefits.
Sound from Reuters. Protesters held signs that said no to occupation and showed pictures of civilians killed during the war. They also directed their criticism to Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who they called a puppet of the U.S. government. So far this year has marked the highest total of Afghan civilians killed since 2006 when the UN began recording accurate data. Some 11,000 civilians have been killed in the past 4 years. 2010 was also the deadliest year for coalition military personnel, with 711 troops killed, according to iCasualties, which monitors fatalities in the war. More than 1,700 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan since the invasion began, thousands more wounded. In a message posted on YouTube, Malalai Joya, former member of the Afghan parliament, said democracy could only come from within her country.
10 years ago, U.S. and NATO invaded my country under the fake banners of women rights, human rights, and democracy. But after a decade, Afghanistan still remains the most unstable, most corrupt, and most war-torn country in the world. The consequences of the so-called war on terror has only been made more bloodshed, crimes, barbarism, human rights, women rights violation, which has doubled the miseries and sorrows of our people.
The war has also vastly increased U.S. war spending. New figures from the National Priorities Project show that the U.S. has spent $460 billion in Afghanistan. President Obama has said that foreign combat troops will leave Afghanistan in 2014. There are currently more than 130,000 coalition troops in the country. Some 98,000 are from the U.S. Opposition to the U.S.-led wars is a theme at many of the Occupy demonstrations taking place from coast to coast. Anti-war groups are leading marches and rallies today in Washington, Syracuse, Los Angeles, and other cities to protest the Afghan war. In FSRN's ongoing coverage of the Occupy movement, today we take you to San Francisco, where residents are demanding elected officials slash military spending on the wars and direct those billions to social programs at home. Judith Scher has the story.
Where's the money? Where's the money? Where's the money go? Well, I see they're scaring up some dough. Those who lost in stocks.
Some 350 people converged at the San Francisco Federal Building Thursday, many of them having walked there from the Occupy San Francisco encampment at the Federal Reserve Building about a mile away. Their signs told the story. Bailed out schools. Our future is too big to fail. Resources, not outsources. Jobs, not bombs. Henry Clark lives in Richmond, California, home to oil refineries. He's the founder of the West County Toxics Coalition and spoke to the crowd, linking wars for oil to the toxic air he and his Richmond neighbors are forced to breathe.
Our government is going to countries like Afghanistan, stealing the oil, bringing it to Richmond to the refinery there to be processed, where the refinery blows up in our face. Basically, chemical assaults on the lives of people in our community.
One of the themes of the rally was opposition to military spending. Co-founder of Global Exchange, Kevin Danaher, says that money should go to human services.
The total costs of this war amount to $3.3 trillion. It's one-fifth of the national debt. We have 865 military bases outside our country. We have 240 military golf courses. Could we please shut down the military golf courses and put the money into education and healthcare?
Like other Occupy demonstrations, students are playing a role. San Francisco Academy of Art student Danielle Peterson is paying her own way through school and piling up debt that she says will leave her a slave to corporate society when she graduates. Her sign read, "Student loan debt equals indentured servitude."
In order for me to educate myself higher than a high school level, I've been forced to take out thousands of dollars in loans. So even if education should be considered a right.
Just after midnight on Thursday, police confiscated tents and personal items from Occupy San Francisco's camping space in front of the Federal Reserve building. But activists say that has made them even more determined to remain where they are. They say more people are coming daily and new groups are forming to occupy Berkeley, Oakland, Santa Cruz, San Jose, and Sacramento. Judith Scher, FSRN, San Francisco.
Today in Syria, security forces fired on protesters in locations across the country, killing at least 7 people and wounding more. A prominent Syrian Kurdish opposition figure was killed in the city of Qamishli. An activist said pro-government gunmen beat another leader outside a mosque in Midan. The death toll of those killed in protests against the regime of President Bashar al-Assad has risen to more than 2,900, according to new figures from the UN out this week. The protests, which began in mid-March, have taken a turn, with army defectors taking a larger role in the fighting and the opposition coalescing under a national council, which meets tomorrow in Cairo to choose an executive board and key leadership positions. Mohammed al-Abdullah is just back from the council's first meeting last Sunday in Istanbul. He joins us now from Washington. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
First, let's talk about the council itself. Leaders announced its creation last Sunday, saying it includes a broad coalition of secular, Kurdish, Christian, Muslim leaders. What is the aim of the council?
Well, the aim of the council mainly is to form kind of political leadership for the revolution. For it has been 6 months since the revolution started in Syria with no clear political leadership or clear address for the opposition where the international community can talk to or engage with. And that's making some confusion as well when the loss of statements and different political views came from the opposition figures. They don't have the same strategies or agenda. So it's great to have one leadership, one address, and one plan so everybody can line up behind. And that's going to give an image to the international community that then the Syrian opposition is ready to take over the government if the Syrian regime falls down.
You're a member of the council as an independent, and you were part of the effort of bringing these different groups together. What was that process like, and how long did it take?
It took more than 3 months, quite honestly, with the political powers and try to engage them. And everybody should feel a member and a part, and not only invited to join. They need to feel they participated and they did something. So if you don't make them feel they are represented, they're sharing their thoughts and views, and they're helping and being a part of the process making, they won't join. And it's not easy thing when we're talking about a huge group of people. And the other point is a huge part, almost 40% of the council, if not 50%, they are from inside Syria. We did not publish their names for their safety. And engage those people and communicate with them has been a nightmare. Most of them are in hiding sometimes, or for a long time they don't have internet connection, as the government cutting off the internet in the cities they are besieging or attacking.
I want to turn to talk about some events taking place that have taken place in Syria this week, where battles close to the border with Turkey have increased. There's been an increased presence of armed resistance coming from defectors from the military. Is the nature of the protest changing? Is it changing from a peaceful protest to a civil war? Is that an accurate characterization?
Not accurate at all, because the people who's getting armed or who's fighting the army, they are not the protesters themselves. They are an army members, and they've been fighting in the army against the revolution for a while. But now Assad regime is paying the price of pushing the army to smash the protesters and attacking those cities one by one. If we look on the revolution over the map of Syria, almost the army attacked almost every single city in Syria except Damascus and Aleppo. And now the army is formed by people from those cities and those towns from the first place.
Mohammed al-Abdallah, member of the Syrian National Council. One thing that the council did do earlier this week in the announcement is they called on the international community to respond. Now, I want to get your take on the international response so far. The U.S. has been criticized for being slow. The U.N. failed to pass a resolution on Syria Tuesday this week. How do you see the international response?
Still, the U.S. did not use their full leverage in the U.N. and in the countries. I mean, they don't have leverage over Russia, but they have leverage over another country that has a great leverage over Russia, such as Saudi Arabia. So I believe we need international community actions, but the problem with the Syrian government that US and EU, they don't have that leverage they have had with Mubarak. When the US asked him to quit, he did. We don't have this leverage here with the Syrian government, and unfortunately our options is are very few and little, and one of them is to send observers by the UN after issuing UN Security Council resolution. If those observers allowed to be in the country, they can tell who's shooting on who's and tell that the real story. And if the Syrian government really honest about their vision of the story, or their version of the story, they can allow the media, after they blocked the country or blocked the information in half a year almost since the revolution started.
Mohammed al-Abdallah is a member of the Syrian National Council. He joined us to talk about the creation of the council and the next steps for the opposition movement in Syria. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
In Washington, the State Department held its final public comment meeting before making a decision on a permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. The controversial project would bring crude oil from the tar sands of Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. Today's meeting was met with protests from anti-pipeline advocates, as well as a show of force from union workers in support of the pipeline. Michael Lawson has more.
At earlier public comment meetings, industry officials have been accused of bussing people in to crowd out the anti-pipeline speakers. This time, those against the Keystone Pipeline were prepared. Nearly 40 of them camped out overnight to stake their place in line to speak during the comment period. Jacqueline Trevino of McAllen, Texas, was one of those people, but she had mixed feelings about her time outside.
It was interesting, and it was fun, but it was also really stressful and intense because there was some tension with the union representatives over how many spots in line we were taking up and what that dynamic was going to look like the following day.
Trevino, who says her community would be impacted by an increase in refinery activity, is also concerned about continuing to promote a dependence on fossil fuels and what this means for climate change.
We had more wildfires this summer than we've ever seen before, larger and stronger and more difficult to fight than we've ever seen before, the most severe drought we've ever encountered. Texas has actually been in a drought my entire life, and I'm 23 years old.
Those against the pipeline showed their enthusiasm with no Keystone XL stickers. At a rally during the middle of the hearing period, demonstrators held signs urging President Obama to reject the pipeline permit. George Poitras, a member of the First Nations, traveled from Alberta, Canada, the location of the tar sands. In addition to the health effects he's witnessed, Poitras says the tar sands development violates treaty rights granted to First Nations people in the Canadian Constitution.
With the environmental impacts and contamination of our waters and decimation of our forests are all having impacts on our ability to meaningfully exercise those rights to hunt, to fish, and to trap.
In the hearing room, moderators had to remind the audience to limit their reactions. Applause or statements in opposition to the pipeline were met with boos from the union representatives in orange shirts who came mostly from the local area. David Miller, spokesperson with the Laborers International Union of North America, said his group was there in support of jobs, not in opposition to good environmental practices.
We have members who build solar power plants, who build wind turbines. So, you know, we're all about, jobs that are environmentally responsible. And we think this process has been done in a way that's going to make sure that this is built safely and in a way that doesn't harm the environment.
A comment hearing in Nebraska, where there is great concern about the pipeline's effect on drinking water, attracted 1,000 people. Randy Thompson is a landowner who would be affected by the pipeline's construction. He says Nebraskans are angry and TransCanada has not been playing by the rules.
These people have operated with no boundaries. They have been out in our state for 3 years trying to intimidate landowners into signing easement agreements, and they have no authority at this point in the permitting process to enforce eminent domain.
The next major action against the pipeline on November 6th will be a human chain around the White House. Demonstrators will hold up signs of President Obama's quotes as a candidate in opposition to oil. The State Department is expected to issue a decision in December. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
Across the country, disability rights advocates have been pressuring government officials to reform what they call a dated system that puts people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in large state-run institutions. The Justice Department has been investigating some states. In Virginia, federal officials found the state is needlessly institutionalizing hundreds of people, a violation of their civil rights. Although state leaders acknowledge the problem, they've refused to commit to closing the facilities. Brad Kuttner has the story from Richmond.
Justice Department investigators describe Virginia's state-run institutions as stark, segregated environments. Residents live in bare, impersonal rooms. They have little privacy. They don't get any choice in what they eat or watch on TV, and few have opportunities for employment or to interact with people without disabilities. The segregated environment in these institutions facilitates what's called learned helplessness. Maureen Hallowell, Director of Advocacy and Services for the Independent Living Advocacy Group, Independence Center, says this is detrimental to people with disabilities.
Over a period of time, that can result in an individual with a disability not feeling empowered, not being prepared, and having no resilience or experience that will encourage them or support them in being independent or living in a situation with supports in the community.
The Justice Department says Virginia is violating the Americans with Disabilities Act by unnecessarily institutionalizing more than 1,000 people in state-run facilities called training centers. The DOJ investigation also points to the high cost of institutionalization, about $194,000 per person per year, while the cost of community services or group homes averages $76,400 per person. Officials point out that through the cost savings, the state could be serving more people, including some of the more than 6,000 people on the waiting list for Medicaid waivers to pay for community-based services. Kim Goodlow recently received an intellectual disability waiver for her 22-year-old son, Matthew, who was born with tuberous sclerosis and needs comprehensive care. He'd been on the waiting list for 14 years.
we now have access to agencies that can provide caregivers that come into my home so that my husband and I can continue to work.
After receiving the waiver, Goodloe became active with community groups to help other families in need of waiver alternatives.
We need Virginia to quit thinking back in the 60s. We are now in the 21st century. People with disabilities want to live in the community with their friends and their family.
Goodloe's waiting list experience and outlook on the system is shared by other family caregivers throughout the Commonwealth. Deborah Guathme takes care of her 50-year-old intellectually disabled brother, David. Guathme took in David in 2003 after their mother died. He receives meager support from Social Security. Money's been tight for Guathme, too, who, as a real estate agent hit hard by the housing market collapse, is finding it hard to get by.
So, you know, I just don't feel like the support is there, and we kind of feel like we're hung out on our own. And again, it's up to me to, you know, bridge the gaps, and the money's just not there to do it.
David has been on the waiting list for a waiver for 2 years. Guathme had the option of institutionalizing her brother some time ago, but couldn't see removing David from his family setting.
David thrives better, and people like him thrive better around people they know in a family environment. And a lot of these people that are institutionalized certainly deserve some type of family environment, which can be created in a group home with 4 to 5 people living in a group home and a regular person coming in and out.
But some strongly support the institutions, including Charles Fallis, president of Families and Friends United for Central Virginia Training Centers. Fallis's daughter has lived in state institutions for 39 years.
When we first started out, they had about 3,000 residents there, and it was not too good. Wasn't bad, but, you know, it has improved greatly over the intervening years.
Fallis said patients like his daughter would not survive outside of the institution.
These folks require many of them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, attention. And there's no way they're going to get that kind of service out in the communities.
But the Justice Department also found the staff at state institutions lacked knowledge about community-based programs, which independent living advocate Maureen Hollowell says are just as comprehensive as the institutions.
The services and the supports and the socialization and employment opportunities that people have living in the community are activities that allow for the individual not just to be socially integrated, but really to be a member of society.
Governor Bob McDonald has publicly acknowledged the need to increase community-based programs and waiver slots. He proposed and state lawmakers approved about $30 million from the state's general fund to support people with disabilities. About $10 million will go towards 275 slots for Medicaid waivers. Another $9 million is slated for crisis intervention and stabilization programs to help keep people out of institutions. But about $7.5 million will go to the institutions. Hollowell was optimistic after hearing the governor's public and financial support of community-based programs. She said the money hadn't yet trickled down to waiver programs, but any action by McDonald was a good sign.
I think there's great hope now in Virginia between these two things occurring, as well as the administration, their own acknowledgement that the system needs to change.
Virginia and the Justice Department continue negotiations over the issue. Nationwide, more states are closing their institutions, including Alabama, the first southern state to announce such a move. Disability advocates praise the progress while noting that reforms are needed to help nearly 33,000 people who still live in more than 60 state institutions. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Alice Olstein. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Michael Lawson. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Shauna Ray. FSRN is largely funded by listeners like you. More information is available on our website at fsrn.org. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening and have a good weekend. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.